It's Wednesday, May 6th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the New York Times knows where you are, and it's changing text in certain stories to cater just to you. Is it cool or creepy? I'll see what Mike and Ernest think about that. The PGA pulls a reporter's credentials after she used the Twitter app Periscope to live stream a practice round. Pay-per-view customers pirated the Pacquiao-Mayweather fight. We'll look at some of those early copyright battles brewing over live streaming video. And CNN's Sanjay Gupta gets called into surgery, performing a procedure on a small child in Nepal while covering the earthquake there. We'll talk about that too, along with a whole bunch of other things that we hope to get to before the half hour is up. But let's start with some of the coverage of the events in Baltimore the past week or so and how the media played into that narrative. Let me start by asking you maybe about some of the sights or sounds or moments that are going to stand out to you from the week.
I don't know if anything's going to stand out to me. I think, well, I take that back. One of the things that will stand out to me is the fact that you had sources that reporters were talking to live. One in particular was Don Lemon, was talking to the mayor and other police officials. And during the conversation, they didn't like what he was asking them. And he just turned and walked away. They turned and walked away from him. He's still trying to talk to them. And they're like, look, we're done. And I think you're going to see more and more of that, where you have sources who don't particularly care for the kind of coverage that network television is doing. And they're just going to walk away and they're not going to engage.
Just so much that happened, it's kind of hard to pick out a moment or two, but two things that kind of stood out for me, and I guess they sort of had at least the media enabled them. Mm-hmm. I was really surprised at how quickly the prosecutor came back after the autopsy results and the ruling of homicide to charge those six officers, and then the coverage that flowed from that. That was very different from, you know, what I think we came to expect from similar incidents over the past year or so. And then I love the piece of Toya Graham, the Baltimore mom who basically took her son away from a potential conflict with the police and was kind of slapping him around to make sure that he understood that this was not good for you. That was just a moment of video that really stood out.
Interestingly enough, the interviews that she had given to CBS News in the day or two that followed that, she was really uncomfortable by how quickly she had been hailed a hero by different media outlets.
Well, she was hailed as a hero, and there were other people who were attacking her, you know, and she was doing her job as a mom, and she was on camera doing it. I don't really know what else there is to say. She explained exactly why she did what she did, and I think any parent would say that was a pretty rational and loving thing to do.
Well, I think she was uncomfortable with it because she didn't see herself as a hero. Mm-hmm. She saw herself, I'm trying to save my son from becoming a part of something that he's going to regret, the family may regret. He could have gotten hurt out there. He could have gotten killed out there. She had, you know, admonished him not to do it. She went there, found him there, pulled him out. She didn't see herself as a hero. She was being a protective mom, and she didn't really feel comfortable with all the publicity of this. And what it really was people really didn't understand exactly what it was she was doing. And so they tried to use her as some sort of a symbol. And she's saying, look, I'm not a symbol. I'm just a mom trying to protect my son.
Another one of those somewhat memorable moments, especially from the media standpoint, was watching that Orioles White Sox game in a completely empty Camden Yards. We actually live streamed it here at the School of Journalism, thinking of it from both a news event, a sports event, something we haven't ever really seen before.
Well, I think it's one of those situations. I mean, it's sort of, this is what Baltimore is like. The only time that a certain segment of the population comes down is for a baseball game, mm-hmm. or to go and have dinner in the area around where the waterfront, where the baseball park is. And here we have this other area of Baltimore, which has been neglected and feels as if they've been under attack by law enforcement and others, and they're exploding. So we're going to stay away, and we're going to keep people away so that they aren't somehow injured or harmed, or in some cases, they don't have to see this part of Baltimore, which does not look good for the rest of the community.
I don't guess this was an individual moment, but another thing that, you know, sort of fascinated me was the number of people who had their cell phones out and were capturing every single thing that was going on. And there was one example, I think, on our Lynx blog, where we talked about 40 protesters and this whole phalanx of police who were confronting them. And almost every single person, every protester, every journalist with the protesters had their phone out recording everything that was happening. That is going to be par for the course from now on.
Yeah, I think that's what that's exactly what you're going to see. And I think what we're also seeing is that more and more people are getting their news and information from that kind of reporting as opposed to what they see on the cable networks and that sort of thing. And because they feel like that's more real, that's more accurate, that's more authentic than what the mainstream media is showing, which tends to be more stereotypical and doesn't provide the context of information that they're looking
there
for.
There is a story that we added to the Lynx blog specifically about that, something that you had brought to my attention, Ernest. And it really also speaks to that idea of how organically the African-American community has galvanized around social media, Twitter specifically, the idea of Black Twitter, a subculture within that social network that when you and I were talking about this yesterday, you had even mentioned in a lot of ways it's the next generation of the Black press.
It is. It takes on a lot of that form. It's advocacy journalism. I mean, these people are out there and they're not just presenting the information, but they're also advocating for change, for social change, for social justice, for the whole Black Lives mm-hmm. Matter. That whole phenomenon is growing out of that. And one of the things that I think is that the mainstream media needs to understand is that if you really want to connect with that community, you need to understand this. You don't necessarily have to adopt the advocacy part of it, but you do need to understand it and understand that this is where they're getting their information. And if you understand that, you can better articulate those messages to a larger community.
Don't you think, too, that whether you call it advocacy journalism or social activism or whatever, there have been a lot of critics in the past few years who talk about younger people using social media for activism as kind of activism light. But really what we're seeing now in case after case with these protests, that this is a new form of activism that's really generating results, especially getting the media and politicians to pay attention to problems that they might not have paid attention to.
No, previously. You're absolutely right. I mean, the other night, President Obama was on Dave Letterman and Dave Letterman asked him a specific question about, you know, did he see something different? And he said, yes, the difference here is that everyone has a cell phone and everyone has a camera on that cell phone and video doesn't lie. And that, and people are beginning to see these things that they didn't see normally. And the entire country is seeing it. And the way in which these communities deal with law enforcement has now opened up to a larger audience. And by way of doing that, people are starting to think anew, I guess is probably the best way to put it, about the relationship between communities and law enforcement. And what does it mean to be involved in the criminal justice system as a suspect, as opposed to being on the justice side of it, so to say?
I do think that those of us who are sort of, professional journalists need to think about this notion, though, that with all the cell phone video that's out there, that video doesn't lie, because I do think we need context, and especially context for live videos. More and more people are using Periscope or Meerkat to send out live video. Without the proper context, we can read into things that are not there from that video.
No, I think you're absolutely right. But I also think what we need to be aware of, those of us who are in the media, is that we have to get all sides of the story. And for a long time, when it comes to covering criminal justice, we've listened to the official sources. And now we realize that sometimes, often, that side of the story is not telling the truth, and that's where these videos are coming into play.
Or has a bigger megaphone with
exactly.
which to speak.
You got that from that Washington Post story yeah. that you brought to our attention. I mean, the Post had one source for a story about, you know, Freddie allegedly trying to hurt himself mm-hmm. in this van. They had no corroboration from the person who allegedly said that. They had no other source but that one, and they were running a story, and worse, a headline mm-hmm. that suggested that they were taking the cop's word for that.
Well, it took days to correct.
Yeah, the initial coverage of the man who was shot in the back in North Charleston, South Carolina, was that the police had done all these other things, and then when the video comes out, what they claim to have happened in that incident is totally different from what was on the video, and that's why the murder charge was placed on that officer, as opposed to he was acting in the line of duty. So
another one of the storylines that came into play here had to do with language and how when certain people use certain words, it can strike a nerve. That's what happened after both the Baltimore mayor and the president of the United States called those protesters thugs. Take a listen to City Council member Carl Stokes' reaction on CNN's Aaron Burnett out front.
The mayor of Baltimore, who's come under a lot of criticism, scathing criticism for her handling of this, referred to the people who were doing this last night as thugs. And she got a lot of criticism for that. There were people I saw on Twitter saying, why would you call them thugs? Then they're not going to listen to you. President Obama also called the protesters, in his words today, quote unquote, criminals and thugs. He also carefully chose to use that word. Isn't it the right word?
No, of course, it's not the right word to call our children thugs. These are children who have been set aside, marginalized, who have not been engaged by us. No, we don't have to call them thugs.
But how does that justify what they did? I mean, that's a sense of right from wrong. They know it's wrong to steal and burn down a CVS and an old person's home. I mean, come on.
Come on. So calling them thugs, just call them. No, we don't have to call them by names such as that. We don't have to do that. That is exactly what we've sent them to. No, when you say come on what? You wouldn't call your child a thug if they should do something that would not be what you would expect them to do.
So Soledad O'Brien has been front and center on this, appearing on several of the Sunday morning talk shows, saying that she basically thinks that the word thug has become a proxy for the N-word and that instead of using that word, the media should be using actual adjectives and adverbs that describe what's going on that scene. If it's a peaceful protest, an angry protest, if there are drunk protesters, not to use that word.
I would agree with Soledad O'Brien on that. I think if the media does a better job of actually describing what's going on, and talking to people on the ground and getting their voices and what they think about it, I think we'd be doing a much better job instead of interjecting our own thoughts. And what the problem I had with that piece, and this is the fourth time I've seen it, mm-hmm. The problem I have with that is that you have the anchor sitting in a control room or on a set in New York having this sort of back and forth conversation about a word and interjecting her own opinion about what these people were thinking and doing at the time of these incidents. And I think that's one of the reasons why the congressman got upset about that. It's like, wait a minute, you know, you're giving your opinion.
That city council member has some very serious points.
So, I mean, we're talking about the language, mm-hmm. and language does matter. Words matter. But I don't think that using the word thug and equating it with the N-word, there is no substitute for the N-word. It is a bad word. You need to leave it alone. And saying that the N-word is used to represent, or thug is used to represent the N-word, I think that's just going a little bit too far on this subject.
I mean, I think you could, after a while, words become crutches. You know, journalists and others are lazy, and thug, well, I mean, it means a violent criminal. In certain circumstances, that word is an appropriate word to use. You can call them looters or violent protesters or whatever is appropriate to that specific situation. But when we use it as shorthand, and especially when we use it for shorthand, when it's mostly African-American people who are doing a certain kind of behavior, we don't use that same word when it's non-black people using that kind of behavior, then that's where you get to be a problem. Or as I think somebody on the Links blog mentioned the notion that, well, if you call them thugs, well, then that sort of means that their anger isn't justified. We can just sort of categorize them in such a way that we don't have to listen to their concerns. That's when it's a problem.
And the other thing that bothers me is that why all of a sudden is there a controversy because of one word that the mayor used or one word that the president used? What about putting all of that into some sort of context and talking about what is the real issue here? What's going on? But we will spend an hour talking about the use of one word instead of
the problems of the root of the issue.
Exactly.
But, you know, I will say that if I were somebody trying to get the media and politicians to pay attention to the larger problems, knowing how social media works these days, I might start up a controversy around the word thug as a way to get folks like us to have this conversation.
But you have to move past that. And the problem is that more often than not on these cable shows, they don't move past the conversation of the word itself.
Okay, so let's talk about a couple of other things that have gone on in the past week or so. Like the big sports weekend that was, there was baseball and golf and the Kentucky Derby and what became one of the biggest boxing matches ever. And like with so many other things, the fight itself became secondary to the other storylines that developed outside of the ring. For instance, two female reporters who said Mayweather was behind the revocation of their press passes for the fight after asking some questions that he didn't like. What went on there?
Well, I think part of it, especially with the two women reporters who had their passes taken away from them, is his camp didn't like the fact that they had brought up the domestic violence that he actually spent time in prison for. And that sort of, they didn't want that story out there. They wanted the story to focus in on the fight and what he's done in his career, his boxing career, and that sort of thing. And when they brought that up, they felt like, hey, one of the ways to shut that narrative down is to take away their press passes. And what they realized is by doing that, you actually caused that to become a part of the larger story.
There were a lot of journalists who showed solidarity for these two women. In fact, Katie Couric reportedly was among those who was in Las Vegas for the flight and decided for the fight. And upon hearing all of this, caught a flight and went back home because she wasn't going to attend and be a part of it.
I've got to say, too, it says something about the level of corruption in boxing and the control that promoters have over a sport. Can you imagine any other major sporting event like this where one camp could say, don't give them credentials, and the organization that was sponsoring the event would pull them? Come on. Well, that wouldn't happen.
There were a whole bunch of other problems, again, all outside of the ring. Cable companies found that their pay-per-view offerings were so popular that several of them crashed and they couldn't deliver on the broadcasts. Other people who were able to tune in after plopping down that $99 or whatever it was, took Periscope and started pirating it, and people watched the fight for free online.
Yeah, the Periscope, I think, is going to be the lasting issue here, because I think it opens up this sort of Pandora's box of what can happen with live streams. And these are you're talking about lucrative fights. People have put down a lot of money. You have a lot of corporations that are involved in this that are looking for profits. Now we're starting to hear the NFL is concerned about it. Major League Baseball has recognized that it's happening at their games, and they're trying to figure out how to control it.
The NHL put in a ban at the beginning of the playoffs.
I don't like the fact that they're doing this. They are pro sports, and in essence, they're sort of private leagues, although our Congress enables them to succeed by exempting them from, you know, the antitrust laws. But it's going to come down to colleges. There are going to be major colleges, and probably not the University of Missouri, but one of them, where journalists who want to do live streaming of practice sessions before a game or halftime or whatever are going to be told you can't do it. Okay, how are you going to stop the thousands of fans who are at those events from doing the exact same thing?
Well, and I think Periscope is really concerned about this, because they have the ability to pull some of this stuff down, and they're gonna receive a lot of pressure from these private corporations and from these sports leagues, including, could be the University of Missouri, could be the Southeastern Conference, NCAA, who knows, is gonna say, look, you have the ability to do it, you pull it down. If not, then we're gonna sue you.
Well, and the PGA, another thing that I was hoping we would have some time to talk about today, also revoked Stephanie Way's credentials. She's a blogger who covers the PGA for live streaming a practice round at a tournament last week. And Ernest, you had mentioned that you had gone to a PGA tournament simply as a fan, right?
Well, I was actually there. I was working. I was volunteering for it with a friend of mine. And the PGA is really strict about the use of cameras and the use of cell phones. And basically, if you're volunteering, they're instructing you to tell people to put their cell phones down, because they feel like that is their product. That's how they generate money, and that's how they make a profit. So they're going to push back on that.
I mean, she was violating tour rules, but on the other hand, if a reporter for the network that had the broadcast rights to that event were doing the exact same thing, they just said, what a great innovative way to generate more audience among young people for golf. So, okay.
So Boone County isn't such a great place when you're looking at upward mobility. In fact, according to the New York Times, it's, quote, very bad for income mobility for children and poor families. It is better than only about 17% of counties. I don't know if this is cool or creepy, but the Times is using computers' IP addresses to customize data stories based on a user's locale. I found that out because when I clicked on the link and I was at my home in Columbia, it noticed I had a Boone County IP address. Boone County was the data that showed up right away on that story.
Well, I think this is one of the ways in which journalism is trying to get into using data. We call it data journalism. Yeah. And they're trying to find stories by you being able to pull down census data, economic data, that sort of thing. The only problem with that is if you don't actually go and talk to the people there and find out how they're living their lives and whether or not that economy or that data is working for them, then you're not really getting the full story. So it goes back
It goes back to context again.
I'll agree with that. But I thought not only was it not creepy, I was really pleasantly surprised and thought it was cool when I opened up my phone to New York Times and there was that interactive and it went right to Boone County. The only thing I would say about it was, even though it fit in pretty naturally with the flow of that story, I would have liked it if they'd actually embedded that content right in the main story. Don't make me click on a graphic to get that kind of customization. Just shove it right in with natural language.
Which shouldn't be that hard.
Well, they did use what they call a bot, right? Yeah. A program that took some sort of canned sentences and then filled in some of the content to build the narrative around it. It read pretty smoothly to me, so they could have embedded it into the story.
Okay. Ernest, in the past, I know you've taught the media ethics course. I have a feeling this next topic will be one that could become a case study for that course down the line. CNN's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, went to Nepal to cover the devastating 7.8 magnitude earthquake there. And when needed, he put down his notepad and his microphone and he picked up surgical instruments. Here he is describing how he came to perform a procedure on an 8-year-old girl.
I was asked to do this by the doctors that were there at the hospital. They just need another set of hands. Because the demand is so high, this is a little girl. Her name is Selena. She lives in a more remote area. She just came in today, a couple of days now after the earthquake. Significant head injury. Her home crumbled around her. She was outside, I understand, getting water. When she was brought in, Carol, it was the whereabouts of her parents were unknown, and she had a brain injury.
During that the producer ran video of Gupta in the surgical suite operating on the child, which brings me to my question, where is the line here?
Well, I mean, when it comes to cable news, who knows where the line is? That line is moving all the time, and this is another instance in which, and this isn't the first time Sanjay Gupta's done something around
similar stuff in Haiti.
It doesn't surprise me at all. I would say that if he's been asked to do this, and his help is really necessary and really going to save someone's life. I don't have a problem with him doing that.
Which, as a neurosurgeon, he's got some very specific skills that could come in handy.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with what he did. I don't have a problem with him saying, describing what he did. But I would prefer to see that after he's done doing that, as opposed to them being inside the operating room and showing all of that. But does it surprise me? No, he's done this before. It may help CNN in a ratings bump. The audience itself may be enamored with it. I feel a little queasy about it, but I'm not going to jump down its throat on it.
So. I mean, I actually applaud him for doing the surgery because
I do too.
That's the human thing to do, and it's the professional and moral thing
and
for a surgeon to do.
The Hippocratic Oath as well. Yeah.
But for CNN, first of all, to tape the surgery,
we don't know
if they got any clearances, so there's a privacy question there. And then to promote it just seems kind of unseemly. Let other people report that story that he did this brave thing, and CNN will still get the credit for it. However, there were some people that were trying to defend Gupta, and they were saying in the comments section on one of the stories that, well, CNN might not have let him perform the surgery if they had. Are you kidding me? If CNN had decided they weren't going to let him do the surgery unless they could tape it, somebody would have told some other media, and that would have been the straw that broke CNN's back.
See, and the other part of this that's kind of interesting, Mike, you had brought up the privacy issues. we would never see this happen in the United States because of our privacy laws, because of proximity and that kind of ickiness of, is that an okay thing to do or not?
Well, but you also have the legal implications of a hospital here allowing something like that to happen. You're right. In Nepal, you don't have those kinds of restrictions, whereas if you tried to do that here, you would have to have that set up way ahead of time with a whole bunch of lawyers involved. It probably still wouldn't fly.
Still wouldn't. Well, not all of us have the skills someone like Sanjay Gupta has. I know I'm no scientist, and oftentimes I know I have a hard time editing science stories out of the fear I'm going to miss some salient point. It looks like that might have been what happened with a story on NPR last week about the politics of mammography recommendations. The reporter, Juana Summers, who I should mention is a former student of ours, had a report that was an incremental look at the back and forth between the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force and Congress. The task force says women under the age of 50 might not need routine mammograms, but Congress passed legislation to override that recommendation. Well, Summer's story, which you can listen to on our links blog, drew sharp criticism from doctors who said it lacked scientific context. And NPR's ombudsman seemed to agree. This is a toughie, given that Summers is a political reporter. She was covering politics, but the ombudsman said it was missing some science.
And it was missing some science. Now, not every story needs to have all the background and all the balance. If it's part of continuing, ongoing coverage, and this is one aspect of the story, then that's perfectly okay. But I think because there wasn't all that additional context in CNN's other coverage that day or that week, she should have provided some in her story. Her editors made that kind of excuse about it. Well, it was just a political story. But truthfully, you have to at least explain what the background is and why Congress would so vehemently disagree with a panel of scientists.
I mean, there are so many political stories out there, and especially when you start talking about it in the medical field. I mean, the politics gets involved because you have one group who is for it and another group who's against it. She needed to have more information in that story so that the audience could understand what are the two sides of the story. And you needed more science.
What in the newspaper world we would have called a matter.
Yes,
kind of that
yes.
background that's just a paragraph or two that explains and gives just kind of that setup of why or how this is important.
You know, even if there had been some of that context, one of the problems you're always going to have to deal with science stories is what's going to be more compelling to an audience? These individual stories like Congressman Deborah Wasserman Schmidt talking about how they detected my breast cancer at 41, or the science, which is based on statistics and large groups of people and probabilities. Always people are going to go with that human connection rather than the science, I'm afraid to say.
Well, and the way the story was constructed, because I heard it on Morning Edition the first time, it was very compelling leading into Wasserman Schultz's personal story. Well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today. That's on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll talk about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan and Maya Jackson for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Kristen Rolwing is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.